You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara. You're going to love it.
The amazing Kate Casey.
Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. I hope that you've had a great week, and I'm so glad that you have found me for this episode because it's something that I've been working on for a long time. I always tell you guys that there are some stories that really stay with me, and this is one of them. It's the subject of the new docuseries on Hulu called Captive Audience, which is about the Stainer family. But this story really begins with the 1989 miniseries, I Know My First Name is Steven, which told the true story about the kidnapping of a child named Steven Stainer. The two-part series aired in May and was watched by 40 million people. I've personally probably watched it 25 times. It's a story that has stayed with me since I watched it on live television as a little girl. Nominated for a Golden Globe and four Emmys, including Outstanding Miniseries and Supporting Actor in a Miniseries or a Special for then 17-year-old Corin Nemec, thanks to his heart-wrenching turn as Steven. The new Hulu docuseries, Captive Audience, A Real American Horror Story, takes an intimate look at a tragic and terrifying saga about the Stainers, a family with five children in Merced, California, that experienced the unthinkable and twice, two immeasurably tragic stories. On December 4th, 1972, seven-year-old Steven was abducted by child molester Kenneth Parnell, and at age 14, he managed to escape with another of Parnell's victims, Timothy White. And then Steven's older brother, Kerry, was convicted of the murders of four women between February and July of 1999 near Yosemite National Park. Kerry Stainer was sentenced to death for the murder of the four women and is still on death row at San Quentin Penitentiary in California. So in this episode, I had the great privilege of interviewing Ashley Stainer, Steven's daughter, who lost her father in a motorcycle accident when she was only 4 years old. And then I also spoke with April Rocha, who had an eerie experience with Kerry Stainer alongside her friend in 1999, just months before he was arrested. And then finally, in a total pivot, I was so excited to talk to Jen Sullivan from Fat Mascara Podcast because I wanted her to watch Not So Pretty on HBO Max, an investigation into the trillion-dollar cosmetics, beauty, and personal care industry, raising awareness about the dangers in everyday makeup, hair, skincare, and nail products. Jen and her podcast partner, Jess, do a great job of walking us through so many issues within the beauty industry. So I was eager to hear what she thought of the docuseries. I'm so glad that you're with me today. And here we go. Three weeks before Christmas 1972, the course of Steven Stainer's life would change forever. Raised in the peaceful suburbs of Merced, California, the seven-year-old was shuffling home from school on just another Monday when he was kidnapped by Texas-born drifter Kenneth Parnell and held captive for 7 years. He had offered him a ride home from school, but instead drove a confused Steven to his cabin. Over 2 weeks, Kenneth Parnell convinced Steven that he had been granted legal custody of the boy because his parents could not afford to have so many children and that they did not want him anymore. Parnell began calling him Dennis Gregory Parnell, retaining Stephen's real middle name and real birth date when enrolling him in various schools over the next several years. Parnell passed himself off as Stephen's father, and the two moved frequently around California, often living in rural areas where people didn't ask many questions. Parnell allowed Stephen to begin drinking at a young age and to come and go virtually as he pleased. Parnell had also moved from one menial job to another, some of his work requiring travel and leaving Stephen unguarded, causing an adult Stephen to remark that he could have easily used these absences as opportunities to flee, but he was unaware how to summon help. As Stephen entered puberty, Kenneth Parnell began to look for a younger child to kidnap. On February 14, 1980, Parnell and a teenage friend of Stephen's named Randall Sean Poorman kidnapped 5-year-old Timmy White in Ukiah, California. Motivated in part by the young boy's distress, Stephen decided to return the boy to his parents. On March 1, 1980, while Kenneth Parnell was away at his night security job, Stephen left with Timmy and hitchhiked into Ukiah. After they were unable to locate Timmy's home, they went to a police station. By daybreak on March 2nd, Parnell had been arrested on suspicion of abducting both boys. Both children were reunited with their families that day. The title of the book and the film are taken from the first paragraph of Stephen's written police statement given during the early hours of March 2nd in Ukiah. It reads, "My name is Stephen Stainer. I am 14 years of age. I don't know my true birth date, but I use April 18th, 1965. I know my first name is Stephen. I'm pretty sure my last name is Stainer. And if I have a middle name, I don't know it. I brought in Timmy because I didn't like what was happening," Stephen Leight explained to the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat, a variation of what he told police and reporters for a long time afterward. "It happened to me, and I didn't want to see it happen to anybody else." This is really so phenomenal for a child to be gone 7 years and to be found alive. The boy's mother, Kay, told the reporters who flocked their home on March 2nd to cover the joyous, unlikely conclusion to the family's ordeal. Kay said, "We expected him to come back. We had hope, faith, and kept busy." And added his father, Dell, "I never stopped looking. Every time I saw a crowd on TV or a picture of a lot of people in a magazine, I always looked very closely in hopes of spotting Stephen." The parents of five painfully kept all the presents their son never got to open after going missing a few weeks before Christmas in 1972. And Stephen became a hero. Talking remotely to Good Morning America on March 14th of 1980, Steve and his mom and his dad on either side of him said, "It was great to be back, but his siblings had changed a lot. I never recognized either of them." In 1981, Kenneth Parnell was tried and convicted of kidnapping Timmy and Stephen in two separate trials. He was sentenced to 7 years, but was paroled after serving five. Parnell was not charged with the numerous sexual assaults on Stephen and other boys because most of them occurred outside the jurisdiction of the Merced County prosecutor or were by then outside the statute of limitations. The Mendocino County prosecutors, acting almost entirely alone, decided not to prosecute Parnell for the sexual assaults that occurred in their jurisdiction. Kenneth Parnell died in 2008 in prison at the age of 76 while serving a 25 years to life prison sentence for solicitation to commit a crime, trying to buy a human being and attempted child stealing. He had asked his home health worker if she could help him procure a 4-year-old boy, offering to pay $500 to have him delivered to his house in Berkeley. She reported him to police, and he got the maximum sentence due to California's 3-strikes law. After returning to his family, Stephen had trouble adjusting to a more structured household, as he had been allowed to smoke, drink, and do as he pleased when he lived with Parnell. The media granted him little privacy, showing up regularly to ask him about the kidnapping and his acclimation. In an interview with Newsweek shortly after the escape, Stephen said, "I returned home almost a grown man, and yet my parents saw me at first as their 7-year-old. After they stopped trying to teach me the fundamentals all over again, it got better. But why doesn't my dad hug me anymore?" Everything has changed. Sometimes I blame myself. I don't know if sometimes if I should have come home. Would I have been better off if I didn't? Stephen underwent brief counseling but never sought additional treatment. His father, Del, voiced often that therapy was unnecessary, and he also refused to disclose all the details of sexual abuse he endured from Parnell. His sister shared that he was bullied by other children at school for being molested, and he eventually dropped out. He began to drink frequently and was eventually kicked out of the family home, and his relationship with his father remained strained. In 1985, he married 17-year-old Jody Edmondson, with whom he had two children, a daughter, Ashley, and son, Stephen Jr. He also worked with child abduction groups, spoke to children about personal safety, and gave interviews about his kidnapping. He joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints just before his death. On September 16, 1989, he sustained fatal head injuries while on his way home from work when his motorcycle collided with a car in a hit-and-run accident. The alleged driver of the car was later identified by witnesses. 500 people attended his funeral, at which 14-year-old Timmy White was a pallbearer. Stephen Stainer's kidnapping and its aftermath prompted California lawmakers to change state laws to allow consecutive prison terms in similar abduction cases. There were five children in the Stainer family. Stephen was the third. Three sisters, two brothers. And as if this family had not already endured enough, there would be another traumatic incident involving Stephen's older brother, Carrie. In July of 1999, the name Stainer made headlines once again when Stephen's older brother, Carrie, was arrested for murdering a woman in Yosemite, California. The connection, once people realized it was indeed the same family, felt improbable. On July 24th, hours after being charged with the murder of Joy Ruth Armstrong, a 26-year-old nature guide who was found decapitated 2 days beforehand in a densely wooded area of Yosemite, just a few hundred feet from her home, Carrie confessed in an off-camera jailhouse interview with San Francisco's KBWB-TV to also killing Carol Sund, 42, her daughter Julie Sund, 15, and the girl's friend Sylvania Pelosa, 16, that past February. He had been working as a maintenance man and living in Yosemite Cedar Lodge, where the trio were staying. Carrie had been interviewed early on in the investigation, a massive undertaking involving local and federal authorities, and ruled out as a suspect. Police first linked him to Armstrong's July 21st murder when his vehicle was reported to be near her cabin an hour after she was known to have been dead. He agreed to let them search his truck, but balked when they wanted to look in his backpack, wondering if Armstrong's head was inside. It wasn't. But when Carrie didn't show up for work the next day, authorities put out an APB and the FBI arrested him at a nudist colony in Wilton, California. In an interview with Ted Rollins, a famed court reporter who was also featured in Captive Audience, none of the women were sexually abused in any way after admitting that he was guilty of all four murders. I wish I could have controlled myself and not done what I did. It was Rollins who also reported that the then 37-year-old Carrie also said he had dreamed of killing women for 30 years, and these four were at the wrong place at the wrong time. This would mean that Carrie was seven when he first had a fantasy, and Stephen was three and still several years away from being kidnapped, a trauma that couldn't help but affect the whole family, and which certainly was invoked when it came time to mount a defense. FBI agent Jeff Rinnick, one of the agents who arrested Carrie and then spent 90 minutes in the car with him driving to Bureau headquarters in Sacramento, remembered to the San Francisco Chronicle in 2002 how the suspect willingly talked about what happened to his brother. He also seemed angry at the driver who fatally crashed into him and ticked off by the light sentence given to Parnell, who was a free man at the time. Carrie pled guilty and was sentenced to life in prison for killing Armstrong. However, prosecutors were intent on seeking the death penalty for the murder of Carol, Julie, and Sylvania. He pled not guilty by reason of insanity, but it was convicted on all charges in August of 2002. Both Dell and Kay Stainer testified during the penalty phase of the trial that October that they neglected Carrie to a degree when Stephen went missing. His sister Cynthia testified that their dad was on a mission after Stephen disappeared, and looking for their brother consumed his time and energy to the detriment of his other kids. "We were kind of on our own," she said. "We tried to keep quiet and not upset our parents." Hearing about Carrie's traumatic past or childhood issues didn't sway the jury, who recommended the death penalty, and a judge agreed. He remains on death row at San Quentin State Prison, though California hasn't executed a prisoner since 2006, and Governor Gavin Newsom imposed a moratorium on carrying out the death penalty while he's in office. Del Stainer passed away in 2013. Featuring interviews with family members, including Mother Kay, some of whom are speaking in depth for the first time, this series delves into the aftermath of Stephen's abduction, the retelling of his story in the indelibly titled 1989 miniseries, I Know My First Name is Stephen, and the unraveling of his older brother, Cary Stainer, who's currently on death row. And what makes this series so extraordinary is you ask yourself how it would be possible for a family to experience this much pain and devastation, but also that it flips for them, and then they became the family of the perpetrator of the worst possible incident. The director includes recordings of executives, TV executives, discussing proposed audience-friendly tweaks to the series. Can you imagine that? And Corin Nemec, who played Stephen, and Todd Eric Andrews, who played Cary at 18, reflect on the stranger-than-fiction chain of events in captive audience, as well as read Stephen and Carrie's own words from interview transcripts. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way that you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, and they pass the savings on to us. So I just got a 100% organic cotton tiered maxi skirt in red and a chiffon pleated midi skirt in soft pink. Now I'm going to wear both of them with either a white scoop t-shirt or a black tank top. In fact, wait, should we all get the same outfit and meet for drinks? Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/KKC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/KKC to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/KKC. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. If you're looking for new style inspiration, Saks.com is the place to go. Saks.com is making it easy for me to shop for the spring with their selection of chic clothes and accessories. Right now, I'm looking at Saks.com so I can find my new going out vibe. I'm looking for a breezy Zimmermann dress for an evening cocktail party. And for my upcoming conference in Los Angeles, I'm looking at bright Chloe blazers because I'm pushing myself to wear more orange and pink. Saks.com will inspire you to shop for everything on your agenda. So find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. This is such a great privilege. Thank you so much for spending some time with me this morning.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I can't even imagine what it must be like to have so much of your family's story be part of media attention all these years. First, I want to talk about your dad, because I'm telling you, that story of his kidnap and returning home has stayed with me so many years. I think it was the first thing that I really watched that I really understood the magnitude of what a kidnapping can do to someone and to all of the members of their family. So how early into your life did you realize people really knew who your family was, that your father was not someone who lived like a private life, that people on the street not only knew him, but they knew his story?
It wasn't until I was a lot older. I wasn't raised with him being well known. I knew what had happened to him, but I didn't know how big it was to everybody else. It wasn't until my Uncle Cary got arrested that my dad's story started coming to light to me whenever my Uncle Cary's story was also being told. So it was two things at once. I was learning about my uncle, and then I was also learning a lot about my dad.
So you were almost 4 years old when he was killed in a motorcycle accident.
Yes.
Right? So yes. That happened in September, and you turned four in December.
Correct. Yes.
And it wasn't until you were at church that you really realized he was gone.
Right. Yes. We were getting a blessing. And I didn't know why I was going up there. My mom just took us up there to the front of the church, and they were giving us a blessing. And it was when they were talking, like blessing us, that's whenever I kind of realized, like, oh, so my dad's not coming back and he's gone. And that's kind of when it clicked for me.
Was your family, your dad's part of the family around you as a child, were they present in your life?
No, they only came around a couple of times, and not because they didn't want to. It was just the step family that I was in kind of kept us away from that side of the family. They would come and stop by to drop off a birthday present or some Christmas presents or attend a graduation or something like that. So they weren't like an every day or even a every month presence in my life.
Did your brother at any point say to you, you know, our dad is famous?
Stephen was a lot younger than me, so I don't even think he really realized either. And yeah. So like, and then like, you didn't really talk about it either in the house. So it was kind of like, we just didn't talk about it. You know, it was just one of those things. I remember one time, like my stepdad, who was not a nice man, while everything was going on with Uncle Kerry and the media, had told me that just some really awful things about my dad, and basically talked bad about him and the ordeal that he went through. And I'm not going to repeat the words because they're just so shameful to repeat, but so whenever you're told things like that by an adult, you just don't talk about it around that adult. And he was around a lot, so we didn't really talk much about my dad.
So once you were interested in the case of the missing hikers in Yosemite,
yes,
and following it to some degree, and then you find out that your uncle is tethered to this story, and then also find out what has happened to your own father.
Right.
Walk me through what that must have been like, because that seems overwhelming to say the least.
It was, but in a sense, I it gave me access to my dad in a way that I hadn't had access before. So even though, like, you know, the news, they like to repeat the same thing over and over. You know, if there's no new information, they just kind of say the same thing every news broadcast until it kind of dies out. But I would sit there and I would watch every single night, even though there was nothing new, even though it was the same thing over and over, just because I wanted to get every single detail of everything and make sure that I remembered every single detail.
So once you find out this information, did your mom share the bigger story of what happened to your father?
You know, she didn't really even talk about it really either. My fiance had passed away too, right before my daughter was born. And I remember while I was going through my grief and stuff, I had asked her, you know, how did you deal with dad? Like, how did you deal with him dying, and how did you, you know, what did you do to make yourself feel better and move on? And she said, I just didn't talk about it. I just stopped talking about him. Like, I just didn't bring him up. Even still to this day, she says, oh, I love your dad. I always will. But she just doesn't like to talk about it.
Which is interesting, because when you watch the captive audience, you understand that when Stephen, your father, returned home, his father, your grandfather, did not support therapy in any way.
Right.
So they almost didn't talk about what had happened for many, many years. And it wasn't until your dad was an adult that telling his story was his own version of therapy. So all the years that he suffered with his own personal anguish and was disallowed to discuss it in the home. Some have suggested that what happened to Carrie, that your father's story may have had some part of it. And it's really hard to know. What did you think when you saw this playback? Do you feel like what happened to your dad and his siblings in the aftermath of his kidnapping and his return had any impact on what happened with your uncle?
I don't like to say that they are, that one caused the other, only because I think it just takes so much away from my dad and his story. So I really tend to not compare the two or even put the two together, but it's hard not to, because it's like, well, I mean, they grew up in the same household, kinda, and, you know, had the same parents. And, but at the same time, my dad was, he did something phenomenal. You know, he did something amazing. And it shows the type of parenting that he had growing up the first 7 years of his life. So how does a person that was only in a home for 7 years and away for 7 years in a horrible home still have those, you know, morals and just values to be able to do what he did. But yet his brother, who grew up in that same home his whole life, ended up killing somebody. So it's just, it doesn't make sense to me. Maybe I feel like maybe it's more like an underlining mental health thing than anything else.
Yeah.
Than an actual environmental thing. Only because I knew that the household they lived in was a pretty normal household, besides the fact that their brother got kidnapped.
And it does seem, with the help of the court expert, that there was a history of mental health that went way before your own grandparents. Did you have any memories of your uncle growing up?
No, I do have a couple, but they're just very short and not very many. So he was in and out a lot. And again, I didn't grow up with that, with the Stainer family for very long, my early years. So at one point, whenever about a year after my dad died, I was still going over to visit my grandparents. And that's whenever Uncle Carrie would just show up and, you know, hang out with all the kids, draw some pictures up, you know, cause he's an artist, and do some like Donald Duck or Daffy Duck, you know, drawings, and then go on his way. One time he showed up to drop off some Christmas presents at our house, was there for, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes and then left. And those were pretty much the only two times that I had ever seen him, that I remember that I have seen him.
Your grandmother, have you had any conversations with her as you turned into an adult about what happened to your father?
I haven't, actually, now that I think about that. It's just been very, I know it's a very traumatic experience for her, especially now as a mom. Like, I understand more when you have a child, you know. So I don't like to bring things up like that for her, and because I don't want to upset her, but we do talk about him. He's not like a, you know, something that we can't talk about. She does bring him up often, you know, whenever she's talking about, you know, past memories or going on trips or, you know, things that we used to do whenever he was alive. But the actual experiences that he had, I really have never talked to her or even actually thought about talking to her about it.
Oh, you should though.
I know. Now that you say something, I'm like, why? I don't know why I never have.
I think it would be so healing for both of you. And to see her talk about her son is really moving. And I think that would be such a great thing. If anything you've learned from this, I feel like it's the importance of talking and keeping people's memories alive.
Yes.
And it is really an extraordinary story, what happened to your father. And I remember feeling so touched reading that Timmy White was a pallbearer at your father's funeral. So their friendship continued even after he returned. What do you know about that friendship?
I just know that he kept in contact with Timmy through the years, up until he had passed away. And that grandma had kept in contact with his parents through the years. I personally had not met them, or I had not met his parents until my dad's statue reveal. We had like a ceremony at Applegate Park for Timmy and his statue. And I met Timmy's wife and I met Timmy's mom there. And that was pretty cool. I was excited about that. But other than that, I haven't spoken with them before that or even after that.
What do you know? Is there anything that was not included in I Know My First Name Is Steven that you think is important that's part of your dad's story?
Well, just the story in general is kind of off on the movie. My parents didn't meet in school. actually, it's weird, but they actually met because my dad used to work at a meat company. Called Richwood Meats. And that's where he met my mom because he was working there. And the guy that got him the job, who still works at Richwood Meats till this day, knew my mom and her friend, and they came over there. And that's when my mom met my dad, was whenever he was working. So they met there, but also on the other end, that was the same place that he died in front of. Was Richwood Meats. Wow. And the same guy that introduced my parents actually was the one that was the first responder to his accident, because he saw the accident happen while he was working at Richwood. And that's where the side street that the guy that came out that hit him is actually on the same parking area as Richwood Meats. So they met there. And he also died there too.
What do you know of the man that hit him?
I don't know much. He didn't get much time. I think he only got like 90 days. He did flee, so it was a hit and run. And he ended up turning himself in because he realized that, you know, he killed Steven Stainer, you know, and he ended up coming back. He served his time, but after that, I don't really know what happened to him.
Well, how do you think your father's story and the loss of him at such a young age has changed the trajectory of your life?
Oh, yeah. It's changed my trajectory quite a bit. Just with the stepfather that I had, you know, the just absent parenting, I guess. My dad always there. So I feel like, you know, maybe things would have been easier for me. You know, I would have had to learn a little bit less life lessons, you know. But also at the same time, I am who I am today because of, you know, all of the stuff that I've been through. And not having my dad, I don't know if I want to be somebody different, because I'm a pretty strong person and I can, you know, handle a lot of stuff. And I don't know if I would have been able to be the person I am today if it wasn't for having to deal with all of the stuff that I've been through.
And now becoming a parent, I know that you're a foster parent too, and you think about the experience that your father went through in those 7 years. Does it feel in some way like becoming a parent has ripped new holes open because you're confronted as you parent those children by what he had to endure in that time and in the aftermath?
Yeah, definitely. Being a parent's hard. It's so hard because, you know, you look back and you're like, your parents tried their best, the best that they knew, you know, and you're here trying your best too. And you don't want to mess them up like you were messed up, you know,
yeah.
And you just think about, you know, all the bad things that can happen. And you just really, I'm really bad about it. I'm like a helicopter mom, like where I just like, no, you're not going to friend's house, or no, you're not going over to grandma's house. And because of the stuff that I know about my dad and the things that had happened to him, it makes me real wary of other people. I just don't trust, because he was so trusting. You know, you tell your children, you know, you respect adults, and you know, you say yes and you say please. And whenever I tell that to my children, I'm in my head saying like, but that's not right though, because you want them to be able to stick up for themselves if a parent, an adult, yeah, is not doing something right. And, but you also want them to be respectful people too. So you're always trying to find this, you know, play this fine line of how to raise your children the right way without spoiling them too much or not, you know, mm-hmm, disciplining them too much. And I think past trauma on a person just makes it a lot more difficult to do that for a person.
Have you ever asked your mother whether or not your own dad had fears becoming a parent of protecting his children?
No, I've never asked my mom. She's never talked to me about anything like that. My mom worked most of her life. Well, she worked hard most of her life. And because she was always at the office, we were left to kind of fend for ourselves and get to school on time by ourselves and make sure we do our homework and make sure the house is clean before she gets home. And a lot of our childhood was, we were left by ourselves to figure things out.
Yeah.
So, she was there to give us housing and food, but she wasn't there as like an emotional support.
Such trauma, I'm sure. Corin Nemec playing your dad.
Yeah.
You mentioned in the captive audience that when you see him, it's like you want to hug him because you think of your father.
Yeah.
How do you separate your father as portrayed by the media and preserve the memory of who he was just to you?
You know, it's hard to do that when all you have is the media to kind of go off of. I mean, I have pictures. I have a lot of pictures of him whenever I was younger. A lot of them I had given to Jessica to put in the film. Me, you know, riding on his back or him, mm-hmm, in the crib with me, you know. But the awesome thing is by having those things and those pictures, I don't need anybody to tell me what kind of father he was, because I can actually see it. You know, he was a great dad and he was always playing with us. Like my memories of him are of him playing with me, you know, hide and seek and, me laying on his chest. And, you know, I remember those things. And, it's just, I have those things. And it does help me be able to separate the two. It's hard sometimes because it seems like he was a different person on camera, you know, very strong and very, you know, tough and just kind of got to the point and, you know, but really he was, from what everybody tells me, he was very happy. He was always laughing and, So I do, it's like I have two different dads, yes. You know, I have the dad, and then I have the media film dad. So it's, sometimes it's hard to separate the two, but sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, I remember he used to do that, you know?
Well, what an extraordinary dad. What he endured and what he did for Timmy White. And to think about how he single-handedly, with his own personal story, changed the way people parented. He saved so many children, not just Timmy White, but I can't even imagine the number of children that were saved because of his story. So I'm grateful that he told his story and that you did. And this is such an important docuseries. And I'm just so grateful that you took some time with me today.
Yeah, I'm very glad that you asked to have me on. I was very excited to speak with you about it and be here.
Bravo to you for being a foster parent.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I love them just like they're my own, and they will be my own.
Yeah,
for real. In June, all the adoption stuff will be completed. So,
well, if anything, I think that you've continued his legacy on looking out for children.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't really think about it like that, but yeah, my dad was very into like the missing children and helping children thing. So.
I'm
kind of glad that I could do that too.
Yeah. That's great. Well, thank you again.
Yeah. Thank you, Kate. I appreciate it.
April Roach is with me. She has an insane story that goes with this Stainer family story. I'm so glad she's with me. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, so tell me about the experience that ties to this insane story.
Okay, so my friend Dina and I, she had never been to Yosemite. I had been there before. And so we decided to go up there. This is 1999, probably, I don't know, April, May. And we stayed at the Cedar Lodge in El Portal. And we decided to go on a hike. We were young and fit, and so we decided to go to this one spot in Yosemite, and then we decided, like, everyone's like, oh, you should keep going, and so we kept going, like, oh, okay, no problem. They said, oh, yeah, Half Dome, it's just right around the corner. Mind you, it was not. It was 5 hours up to Half Dome. It was 5 hours down to Half Dome, and we were really stupid because we ran out of food and we ran out of water. I mean, it was very irresponsible how we did the whole thing. But as we're walking down, we kept saying, oh my God, all we could think about is steak and potatoes at the Cedar Lodge restaurant. That's all we could think about because we were so hungry and we were so exhausted. So we finally get to the Cedar Lodge restaurant and we say to the girls, the hostess in the front, like, oh my God, we're starving, but we also really want to go to the pool. And they go, oh, Carrie, I'll let you in. Don't worry about it. You know, just give them a beer, even if it's like after the time that they close, don't worry about it. Because there's an inside pool and an outside pool. And this is for the inside pool with the jacuzzi. And so we were just like, you know, we had our lovely steak and potato dinner. And then we're like, well, are you sure? And they're like, oh yeah, he'll let you get it. You know, he'll let you stay there. No problem. Just, you know, it's fine. So like, okay. So we went to the jacuzzi and both, you know, got what we wanted. We were, you know, it felt great to be in it. And I got bored. So, you know, I was done. So I was like, okay, Dina, I'm going to go back up to our room. And so just Dina decided to stay. So Dina is hanging out there in the pool. It's just her. No one else is in there. And someone turns out the lights. And she's like, and it's an inside pool. She's like, hello. And then he turns on the lights and he started talking to her. And I do not know how long the conversation was. But then she got out of the jacuzzi and she was walking back to our room and he said, oh, what room are you in? And Dina somehow was smart enough to know she had the intuition to not give him the room number. So she never did. Mind you, we were in the back of the Cedar Lodge Hotel. If we had screamed, no one ever would have heard us. And some would say like, well, there were two of you. How can you do that? But, you know, he took down three women. So if he took down three women, he certainly could take down two. And the other scary part is a few days before that, our lock on our hotel room got broken. It just like fell apart. And so we called downstairs to go, oh yeah, we'll have a maintenance guy come up. And a maintenance guy came up and it was not Carrie. which was also our good fortune, who fixed the lock for us, but he would have then known where we were as well. And I remember one day we hung out at the pool outside, and the pool above the pool was where it was his apartment. So he also could have watched us, you know, if he wanted to, you know, look down at us if he was, well, I mean, he was the maintenance guy there. So anyway, so because of this, I always tell girls if they're like, you know, driving cross country because they're moving, I always say, share your location at the end of your day or have someone tracking you the whole time. But every single day you tell someone, like do a Google share, Google Maps share of where you are. Because that was sort of my one brush with death. And, you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, going on an adventurous trip by myself, and I sort of always think twice about it being a woman. So I think about it, but I know I can't do it. So
this was 2 months before.
Yes. And I remember I'm a big newspaper reader. So I went outside in the morning, got my paper. This is pre-social media. So, you know, you saw the headlines in the paper typically. So I get the paper first thing in the morning. I look at it and, you know, front page of the LA Times was this thing saying, you know, Yosemite killer caught Carrie Stainer. And I just, you know, Carrie's not a common man.
I thought the same way too.
Yeah. So I was like, looked at this. No way.
No way.
Oh my God. I mean, I couldn't believe it. So that, and I was like, I couldn't believe it. And then Army Archer to Variety, like did a little blurb about it. Inside Edition did an interview with us. And, you know, it was just one of those things where I just, it just makes you much more cautious.
So the maintenance man who came up and repaired your lock, did he seem to be concerned that that happened to your room?
No, it was just a random thing that happened. And there obviously was another maintenance guy. I mean, you know, Carrie probably had a couple of days off as well. I'm sure there was more than one maintenance guy. But yeah, I mean, we just, as luck would have it, he was not the one that came up.
And in your memory of him, I mean, I just remember him being so attractive. Was that memorable? Like, he seems okay.
I didn't meet him. Dina did. See, because I left. But Dina said, because then she read a book by Gavin De Becker, and she talked about he probably was pre-interviewing her. I guess serial killers do that.
Right.
And I don't know. I don't remember what they talked about, but she did say that theoretically that's what he could have been doing when he was talking to her.
Okay. But after this, how long did this take you guys to really come to terms with? Because this is really traumatic.
It just reminds me of like, don't do anything stupid. You know, don't do anything stupid. Don't, you know, don't go, you know, as a photographer, I like to, you know, I'd love to go, you know, explore abandoned ruins of a house in the middle of nowhere. And I know I can't do that.
Oh my gosh. What is the one part of this experience that has really stayed with you?
How the timing of it, and how Dina not telling him what room we're in probably saved our butts, or saved our lives, should I say.
Yeah. I wonder how many women were also in proximity to him in those weeks.
There were a lot of families. There were not a lot of two cute girls. The headline goes away, and then things like the Hulu documentary, like 2020 did one a couple years ago about it, and then Hulu doing this 3-part documentary brought it back again, because it is such a wild story about My Name Is Steven and then Carrie Stainer, both of this family, that it comes back into like the headlines again, and then it goes away, and then it comes back. But you know, I just think about also this hotel. They put us in this back. I mean, literally, no one would have heard us if anything had happened to us. We were so far away from anyone.
Well, tell everybody where they can follow you.
I am at aprilrocha.com. Well, I'm a photographer, so it's aprilrocha.com, aprilrocha.com. I have Instagram. I have a website. I have Twitter, and I have Facebook, and it's all April Rocha.
Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes so you can see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes that you like, so you can find the home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours, and even on the same day, with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Jennifer Sullivan is co-host of Fat Mascara. You guys, you have to listen to this podcast. She and her co-host Jessica give the world of beauty on their bi-weekly podcast. If you want to know anything about beauty, they're the go-to experts. And that is why I have asked her to review this new docuseries. I'm dying to know what she thought of it, because I got to be honest, I watched it and I almost shit a brick. Jen, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. Don't shit a brick, Kate.
This series is interesting because it's four different episodes. And obviously, it, as mentioned, it features four different categories. The first one was about hair, and it was mostly about a product called Diva Curl. And it featured influencers that had done several videos. And I wondered how familiar you were with this story and this product.
You know, we actually talked about the Diva Curl lawsuit on our podcast 2 years ago in 2020, I think. And even before that, we've talked about it on our show because it's been ongoing. This was not news to me, but I realize now it must be news to other people. I feel like it was odd for me that they started with this, because it was one of the weaker links in the whole docu-series for me, when they buried to me the lead about hair discrimination, which I thought was really interesting in the first episode, and also about, you know, lye relaxers and a lot of the other products, and focused so specifically on this one product, which it's been settled, that class action lawsuit settled. So I don't even know a lot of, we don't know a lot of the details of, you know, what went down with the claimants. And not to belittle all of these experiences, which sound horrible. And I'm not negating that these things didn't happen to these people. I'm sure that they did. It goes back to this thing we talk about a lot on our podcast, which is correlation versus causation. You know, we learned this in science class. I'm not saying that this product did or didn't cause those issues, but we don't know what else was going on in their lives while they were using these products. We don't know which of the Diva Curl products they use, how long they use them. It just seems like an odd, very deep dive into one particular thing. Maybe they had some, they were also very beautiful influencers, and I know they made for good visuals, and it's an arresting story. And you, like you said, you shit a brick because you're like, wait. But it's an advocacy documentary. Like, its job is to be alarmist and sort of raise these questions. For me, it didn't answer a lot of questions in that, and particularly in that episode. It just, I would just say, after you watch it, if you're interested, go do some more research and some of the original reporting on this and dig into the ingredients and what happened, and not just take away the alarmist headline, you know? I would never wash my hair again if that were the case, and how we watched, you know, documentaries.
But at the same time, I also thought about all the videos that I've scrolled through where I find myself transfixed. And it's like someone straightening their hair or using a curling iron. And I'm thinking, what got them to the point that they're doing this video, and how honest are they being? And is everyone a liar? And do I need to worry about my hair falling out?
You know what else that part of the series raised for me, which was like, most people might not realize how influencer culture works, and that a lot of these people are getting paid. Because, you know, when you work at like traditional media, like the New York Times or something, you know, you're not allowed to accept money from brands in return for content. But that's literally how the influencer agents, you know, they work. So YouTube, on Instagram, on TikTok, all of that, they're getting paid, and they don't always, I mean, the FTC tries to, you know, make them disclose. They're always like warnings. You must disclose if you've been paid for this, but they don't. And a lot of people that are influencers don't know that you have to.
That's true.
But I feel like people are getting savvier and they're starting to realize like, you know, I need to dig into this and see if it was paid content or not. And in the case of those curly hair influencers, they were being paid by the company. And that was weird too, which is like the company that's paying them is doing them this disservice. Very interesting.
Very interesting.
Again, I haven't seen the details of that lawsuit to know, like, I'm not ready to say like it's because of that product, but
that's I agree.
Me. Yeah. Yeah.
That several other episodes, one hair, body, obviously like more lotions. And it really does make you freak out about nail salons. I'm assuming.
Oh, right. The second episode. Yeah.
That over time, this is going to get better. But do we need to worry when we go out to get a manicure? What do
we
need
to worry for your nail technician? Yes.
Yes.
Your nail technician. The person is breathing that in every day, day in, day out, dealing with those chemicals. And that's the case actually in the hair industry too. Like when there was a lot of hair straightening products that did some off-gassing of formaldehyde when they were hit with heat. This was before they were reformulated. I was less worried about the people that got those treatments than the people that are doing those treatments. And I think that's the big takeaway from the second one. Like those techs are breathing in aerosolized and aerated chemicals that you, as you're looking at your nails aren't like powder's not coming off your nails once you leave the salon, right?
Yeah.
So you're not breathing in the tiny broken fibers and pieces of whatever ingredient may be. But the nail tech is. So do I need to worry? Yes, for that person. What do I worry personally about my own nails and the fact that I might have chemicals on them? No, because I also don't worry that like, you know, my food came packaged in a piece of plastic, which also has chemicals. But each person has their own place where they decide to start worrying. For me, personally, that's not one. But I do worry about the industry. It's like, I'm sorry, a $10 manicure should not exist. Think about the hourly rate, wage, you know? Like for years, this part of the industry has really been taking advantage of the nail techs that work there, both monetarily and their health concerns, you know?
Absolutely. Then we move into the makeup. This is when I really thought, oh my God in hell. I went downstairs.
Tell me why.
I threw out all my daughter's makeup sets, the lipsticks, et cetera. I don't want to talk to them about it because they're going to totally disown me. But I...
Wait, you literally, after you watched it, went and
threw away
all the makeup?
I threw away.
Now, what kind of makeup were they? How old are your daughters again?
Well, I have four of them. And they range from almost 13 to 3.
Okay.
So, like, the 13-year-old has, like, better actual makeup. Yeah, yeah, like real makeup. And she's really into it. But the younger ones, they love play makeup. And they use those eyeshadow sets all the time. And that episode scared the bejesus out of me. So I went down and threw them away because I felt like I need to be a better parent by really looking to the ingredients that are in those products before I let them put them on. Did I go over the top?
I think you did what a lot of people might do after they watch this. And again, I feel like we narrowed in on one particular thing. Talc, which is the ingredient they were talking about that can be contaminated by asbestos, both in the mining and unknowingly during manufacturing, is in all types of makeup, not just Claire's Boutique's play sets. Like, I think clearly you came across with the message that like, oh, the less expensive, cheapy kid makeup is made with this ingredient. Am I wrong to think?
That's exactly right. And then they had another girl who had been putting makeup on and then all of a sudden she has mesothelioma. And I went, oh my God.
Yeah. But then they sort of moved into the baby powder talc thing and they didn't really like parse out the details, which I can understand why you'd be like completely freaked out. But the talc can be dangerous when it has asbestos in it. The big thing was that like Johnson's was put on genitalia of babies for years. And that is, you know, a way to get into the body system. And even that guy that was in the documentary, like he didn't have the experience of your daughter who's like blowing on makeup and breathing in. Now, am I saying that's completely safe? I don't know because I haven't tested every piece of makeup. But in general, I think people forget that companies do safety testing before they put out like products. All of their they buy talc from a company, they want to see the traceability, a good company, obviously. And they do test it and they do not include ingredients that they're not supposed to. But they sometimes do get in there unknowing of the company. I think it came across like Claire's knew it was poisoning children and did nothing about it, which I just don't think that's the case. I mean...
Well, that goes back to one question I had about the first episode is when they were talking about putting hair products on, they said that your scalp is so, it's the most, what's the term?
I paused.
It said that
permeable,
like, yeah. Permeable, so it goes into your bloodstream. And I just thought about all the women I know who got Botox while they were pregnant. And I was like, well, they're fucked.
See, you know? This is amazing to me to listen to you because when I see that, you know, I have years of like writing about this stuff and I'm like, oh God, they gave it half the story. And of course, that's what you think. They made it seem like every hair follicle was a hole and a channel that you pour chemicals directly into. First of all, hair follicles are pores. You have them all over your face. That's what the tiny little vellus hairs come out of. So like it's as permeable as your face too. And no, you can't just, like your skin is... Your skin is there to protect you. Yes, things can get into your bloodstream. It's not like you're pouring, you know, it may seem like you're pouring formaldehyde literally into a hole in your head.
It did.
Right into your brain with a little visual. I paused that visual because I was like, this is alarmist. Now, I'm not saying that, like, there's plenty of studies that show that people have micro amounts of these chemicals in their blood systems and they get in there from like putting them on their skin and putting on their hair. But like, it was too alarmist for me. It, you know, I take it with a grain of salt, which... I don't think you shook the salt. You just went.
So tell me and everybody else what we need to do, what you do when you're about to buy a product.
You know, okay. They also kept sending you to the Environmental Working Group, which is has a lot of scare tactics, I think, but they are helpful in that they can help you read a label. The issue for me, you know what you can do? Work on legislation with your Congress. Because the issue for me is not being able to read a label. You are made not to be able to read a label. The things that they disclose on that label are barely telling you what's in the product. Because, for example, fragrance. It just says fragrance. Mm-hmm. Fragrances usually have multiple ingredients, preservatives in them. Maybe it has essential oils. It could be a natural fragrance. Maybe it has a synthetic molecule in it. We don't know it. There's a lot of ways that they can sort of, not even because they're being nefarious, but just because they're putting the simplest thing on the ingredient label for you. It doesn't really tell you all that much. So okay. I'm hesitant to be like, turn over your product and look for this ingredient. You know, it's just not that simple. If you want to be proactive, call your Congress people, talk about, what does the FDA do? Is it time for us to change the way the FDA works? Because right now, it does not test every product. But also, I don't think they should be testing every product because, like, clearly these companies would not be in business if they were giving, you know, dangerous products to people. So what do I do? I actually don't worry about that much. The thing I worry about more, honestly, is the plastics, the plastic packaging on my food, on my cosmetics, on all of that, both from a sustainable standpoint, but also because of the leaching of microplastics and BPA and those things, which have a lot, you know, I eat a lot more than the makeup I put on. I met your daughter that, even if she loves makeup, like more so we're eating, you know, apples that came in a plastic bag or might have petrochemicals or might have fertilizer. Now, I'm not like alarmist like that at all. I'm just saying, I feel like
bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, well, there's something about the personal care industry that people get especially fired up about because it's such an intimate act, putting on makeup, washing your hair. And like, you almost forget that eating food is like, you literally put it inside you.
Right.
So I'm just like, if you want to get that dialed into it, then also look at what you're eating. Then also look at what you're wearing. Then also look at like the paint you painted your walls with. Like, unfortunately, we cannot get away from these chemicals, even if we go all natural with our cosmetics. Like, they're everywhere. Yeah. So I tend to be of the camp that's very unalarmist. Now, I don't use triclosan. I don't use talc. And I'm wary of, you know, talc powders and putting them on parts of my body.
If you will.
Yeah.
So the answer is not for me to pack up and move to a tribe in the Amazon.
I mean, if that feels right for you for other reasons, you could do that. But like, this happens like in the news cycle often where we get like bombarded, we get all freaked out. And I think a big part of it is we're in a world where we don't feel a lot of control lately.
No.
Like, you get cancer and there's no, you know, and oftentimes there's no reason. Like, your body did something. There's wars that happen you have no control over. There's freaking pandemics. And when there is something that you can control, I think a lot of people feel like, okay, this is the thing that I can control. And they tend to get very
fixated.
Yeah. And I get it because it feels like I'm doing something. Personally, me, I know this might sound like nihilist. I don't know. Like, I can't do anything about it. So I'm not going to freak out about it, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And looking at this docuseries, I was just like, oh, right. People don't know this? Like, I forgot that, like, not everybody already knew all of the stuff in that documentary.
Yeah. Because you're so knee deep in this all the time.
Yeah. And I mean, on my podcast, like every week, like if there's a lawsuit or there's a product that's recalled or new research as far as how they're testing for asbestos and whether it's contaminated talc or mica, don't even get me started on mica and the problems with that. Like, we report on that all along. But honestly, most people don't like work at a nail. Well, actually, people that work at a nail salon or a hair salon, I'm more worried about them than your daughters, if you don't mind my saying so.
I'm glad you said that. And I think that that's a great reminder for us all to be champions for them as well, especially because they're such a part of our ritual or lives, you know?
Yeah.
Think about how often we are going to a nail or a hair salon and their health is just as important as our own. So that's a great reminder. I appreciate
that. Yeah, we had a hairstylist on once and they were like, well, I'm basically an unpaid psychotherapist. And they're that too.
Oh, for sure.
Right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
I told nail techs things I wouldn't tell like people in my family, just because like you're like, okay, it's an intimate act. Yeah. We're here together. So I do worry about the health of, you know, anybody working with chemicals on a day-to-day basis.
Can I tell you something weird? My entire life, every time I go to get my hair done, I notice that the hairdressers talk to other people, but they don't talk to me. And I wonder if it's because I have so much hair that they're like, oh, God, when is this going to be over? How do I handle this?
So while they're doing your hair, they're busy talking to the other clients?
No,
or just you've seen them talk
no,
to
it's
other
like
clients?
It's basically like a Scientology zone. It's like all silence. They're chatty with other people and then they see my head of hair and they put their hands through my hair and they're like, "I there's no way I can focus dealing with this disaster."
What's your resting like salon face? Are you giving them like a warm and opening like please
I just
talk
have,
to me?
No, I have my laptop. I'm like, I know you're not going to talk to me and I have to work. So that's it's
okay.
Fine.
So which came first? Maybe they saw you had your laptop out and they were like, oh,
good
she's
point.
Busy working.
Yeah,
maybe
good point.
I shouldn't bother her.
Good point. Tell everybody where they can listen to your podcast and where they can find you. I want everyone to tune in because you're so good at what you do. You've great guests and you're such a great host. Where can they find you?
You can find us on all the podcast platforms. Fat Mascara is our social handle. That's the name of our podcast. It's me, Jen Sullivan, Jess Matlin. And honestly, we never claim to be like the end all be all know it all. But if we don't have the answer, we definitely know somebody that does. And then we'll have them on the podcast to talk about it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Thank you a million times.
Thanks for having me. It was fun hanging out.
I want to thank my fantastic guests, Ashley, April, and Jen, and remind you to click subscribe, share this episode with your friends. You can text them or email them. I'm so appreciative when you do that. It's so helpful to me, and I just know that so many people would be touched by the story of the Stainer family. I also encourage you to join the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey. Follow me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. My Instagram is at KateCaseyCA, where you can find my must-watch list every Monday, which outlines for you at least 7 things that you should watch this week. You can also get that list at katecasey.substack.com. You can also find me on TikTok at It's Kate Casey, Cameo Kate Casey, and finally, my Patreon with bonus episodes if you go to Patreon, patreon.com/KateCasey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere. With venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk.
He took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift.
She is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
your favorite coffee shop down the street, to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.